NASA has a lot going on these days, and not just the investigation into last evening's explosion of a privately operated rocket at the Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. NASA is receiving high marks for employee satisfaction, and it's also moving ahead with plans to end U.S. reliance on Russia. NASA chose contractors Boeing and SpaceX to transport astronauts to the International Space Station by 2017. Now, last night's crash involved a rocket made and operated by Orbital Sciences, which is not involved in astronaut transport. In this interview recorded earlier, Administrator Charles Bolden tells Emily Kopp about the new rockets and why they're special.
They're American-made. That's the most important thing. And the fact that the launch vehicles they chose, because what we picked was a service. And that means, what everybody focuses on is the thing that's going to carry the astronauts. So that's Dragon from SpaceX and CST-100 from Boeing. But each supplier also had to pick a launch vehicle. And Dragon will be launched on Falcon 9, which is a, an internally produced SpaceX vehicle. And Boeing chose the Atlas V, which is made by a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed and a company called United Launch Alliance. But the big thing is they both will be launched from Florida. So we're bringing the launch of American astronauts and our partner astronauts back to American soil.
So this is all expected to happen by 2017. I know that's not a fixed date, but that's the end goal. What's going to happen between now and then?
There are a number of milestones. A couple of things, since they're federal employees who listen to this a lot, everybody understands contracts and everybody understands fixed price contracts versus award fee contracts. This is a fixed price contract. So both vendors agreed to a set amount of money for this service that they're going to provide. And very quickly, it provides for a couple of what we call certification flights. And that's between now and hopefully 2017. And then following the certification flights and completion of the certification, they can fly up to a grand total of 6 flights for us carrying crews to the International Space Station. So we're talking about potentially 12 missions carrying astronauts into space beginning in 2017.
Okay, and we should say, since we mentioned the contract, that together it's $6.8 billion.
That's correct.
Boeing's going to get the bulk of that.
Yeah, Boeing's contract was for $4.2 billion, and SpaceX's contract was for $1.6 billion.
And are they working together, or are these two developments happening simultaneously but separate?
They're two separate contracts and two separate development programs. In fact, SpaceX's is focused in Hawthorne, California. And Boeing's is actually, right now, I think that much of it was done in Houston, but I think Boeing's plan is to focus most of their operations at the Kennedy Space Center.
And so in 2017, do you expect to choose from the most successful of the two, or do you foresee keeping the two of them going?
Our contract, in fact, we have two contracts for services that I just described, and it's not a down select. It is a they've gone through the competition, so we expect to utilize both of them over the period of time between now and about 2020, 2022.
So let's talk a bit about what this enables NASA to do. You've already mentioned that it enables you to launch from this country, and I suppose that means that you will be saving a big chunk of the money that the U.S. pays Russia to send astronauts into space.
Yes.
That's about $71 million per seat. How much do you foresee this costing? Is it going to be cheaper?
We don't know yet. We will know. This you need to look in the long run. So being cheaper than the Russians was not the most important thing for us. What was important was to stop our dependence on Russia for providing transportation for our crews to and from the International Space Station. So it is our belief that in the long run, since we have been able to maintain competition by having two providers and we have fixed price contracts, our anticipation is that over the long run, it will be cheaper than relying on Soyuz. But that was, while a consideration, that was not the number one consideration. Cost was very important, but the ultimate, what was most important to us was mission success, which includes safety of the crew. And so they could have been the cheapest people in the world, but if we were not satisfied that they can guarantee the level of safety for our crews and the ability to successfully complete each mission, they would not have been selected.
We're speaking with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. And while these projects are being built, you're basically reviving in an economy, at least in Florida, and growing things that will last for a long, long time. How do you see this development as a jumping off point for what the United States wants to do in space?
Emily, our hope and our all indications are that we're not only helping to revive the economy and increase jobs in Florida, it's actually being spread across the nation. If you look at the Boeing entry, for example, the rocket itself, the launch vehicle is produced in Colorado, Alabama, a number of other places. The capsule is being done in parts of it in California, parts in Houston. The bulk of the assembly and checkout is being done at the Kennedy Space Center. And we're launching from Kennedy. So Florida should, in fact, enjoy the lion's share of the economic growth, but it's actually going to entail growth across the country. When you look at SpaceX, in deciding on these two carriers, these two providers, we were not only deciding on vehicles that would carry American astronauts, NASA astronauts, and our partner astronauts to the International Space Station, but we were more importantly providing for the nation a capability to get humans to low Earth orbit. And, you know, we're buying the service, as I said. We're not buying the vehicle. So when we return from a mission on Dragon, SpaceX can turn that vehicle around and fly a crew of people that are contracted specifically to SpaceX. It could be a space tourism mission that lasts a week, where SpaceX could turn the same vehicle around that just spent 6 months on the International Space Station and fly their crew plus five other people for a week of space tourism, where they just fly around Earth, maybe visit the International Space Station, have an opportunity to go on board. Or if everything works out ideally the way that we envision, there will be other destinations over time. Bigelow Aerospace is producing expandable modules for research, for habitation. You know, Bigelow is its founder and its president and CEO is a hotel magnet. So Bob Bigelow's vision is to have places where people can travel to space and live aboard a Bigelow expandable module for a period of time. My hope is that his vision will in fact come to fruition in the next 10 to 15 years, and you will see a vibrant low Earth orbit infrastructure growing up. But, you know, you asked, what is this allowing us to do? The president challenged NASA back in 2010 to do two big things in human spaceflight: put humans with an asteroid by 2025 and humans in the Mars environment in the 2030s. And so that is our ultimate goal, is to get humans on Mars the way that people have dreamed for millennia, for decades and centuries. And so this frees us up from any responsibility of operating low Earth orbit vehicles, and it allows us to focus on the development of the Space Launch System and Orion for deep space exploration and transportation of our crew and other payloads. And it also allows our Space Technology Mission Directorate to develop new technologies, game-changing technologies that will enhance our ability to go into deep space. And because everything we do is a collaboration between science and human exploration, it has expanded the use of robotic spacecraft as precursors for putting humans on Mars. We just put MAVEN into Martian orbit this past week. We have Curiosity that is now exploring the surface of Mars and climbing Mount Sharp. We have Opportunity, the Mars exploration rover Opportunity, which has been there for, boy, a decade. And our partners, the Indians, just days after MAVEN arriving in Martian orbit, inserted a mission that's called MOM, and it's the Indian Mars mission that is now a sister ship for MAVEN, exploring that planet and giving us sending data back to Earth, all of which are precursors to sending humans to Mars.
That's Charles Bolden, the NASA administrator. Again, this interview was recorded before last night's disaster at Wallops Island in Virginia. We have more of the interview. It's going to come up next. And the time is 6:19. Still ahead on Federal News Radio, GSA's Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies has some advice for improving customer service at your agency. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Increased savings, better productivity, safer data, less complexity. These benefits become possible when you have the confidence to maximize your agency's potential through a cloud backed by network-based security. At AT&T, we call it cloud confidence, and you can get it with AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government. Now you'll be able to make the move to the cloud and not hold back from taking advantage of all it has to offer. From collaborating more easily with employees and customers, to accessing data from any web-enabled device, to quickly scaling resources as user demand changes. And that means... Find out how AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government can give your agency the cloud confidence that comes only with the security of the AT&T network. Visit att.com/gov/cloud. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
This is Captain Richard Phillips. In 2009, my United States flagged merchant marine vessel was boarded by Somali pirates. The U.S. Navy intervened and saved my life. Our nation's sea services keep the world's waterways open and help our nation's economy stay strong. Join me as a member of the Navy League of the United States and help support our Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and Merchant Marine so they can stay on the job. Learn more at thenavyleague.org and donate through the combined federal campaign number 58495.
Ball Aerospace exploits cutting-edge open-source technology to transform geospatial information into intelligence. Ball understands the mission, addresses the need, anticipates what happens next. Ball delivers dynamic, interactive, web-based tools to produce actionable intelligence for the warfighter and our nation's leaders. Ball Aerospace, setting the pace for tomorrow's immersive GEOINT environment. Agility to innovate. Strength to deliver. Learn more. Visit BallAerospace.com. That's BallAerospace.com.
GEHA's dental pricing tool is just one of the ways GEHA helps you make smart decisions about your dental care. GEHA Dental offers low premiums, a growing network of dentists, now with more than 240,000 locations, and orthodontia paid at 70%, even for adults. When federal workers have questions about their dental plan, they get answers from GEHA. Learn more at GEHADental.com/pricing. That's GEHADental.com/pricing.
Human Capital Management Government is a highly anticipated training conference with over 150 delegates and key speakers such as OPM Director Catherine Archuleta, Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs Juan Garcia III, and USDA Chief Human Capital Officer Billy Milton. Don't miss this year's event, to be held December 2nd through the 4th at the Hilton Alexandria Marks Center in Virginia. For more information, visit hcmgovernment.com.
6:22, welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. For decades, NASA has partnered with American industry to help build spacecraft. Now, in the second part of an interview with Emily Kopp, Administrator Charles Bolden explains why the relationship between NASA and industry is vital. Again, this was recorded before last night's loss of the Antares rocket at Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. Nevertheless, NASA officials have been saying that their strategy of using private contractors will not change as a result of this loss. Again, here's earlier a recording with Charles Bolden with Emily Kopp.
NASA has very seldom built a major spacecraft. It's always been NASA working in collaboration with American industry. And ironically, I think most people have forgotten that. And so when we talked about commercial crew and cargo, introducing the concept of having allowing American industry to provide the vehicles and NASA by the service, people were many people thought we had lost our mind because they had forgotten that it's been American industry that has enabled this nation to be number one forever. You know, the original Mercury, Gemini, Apollo program, that was American industry. Back then, General Dynamics, Rockwell Corporation, that doesn't even build rockets anymore, Boeing, and Boeing has morphed into the current day Boeing Corporation, but there were a number of American companies that built the spacecraft, took us into space in the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and Shuttle programs. And at the end of Shuttle, the vast majority of the workforce was contractors. So while there will be NASA people working as an integral part of the development of SLS and Orion and our other deep space exploration, we'll be working hand in glove in partnership with American industry. It's always been a NASA industry partnership.
I also want to ask you about the relationship with Russia. I know that, after the conflict heated up in Ukraine, that your agency severed most of its ties with Russian counterparts, but not in terms of the International Space Station. What has it been like for the astronauts and the others working directly with that program?
Our partnership with the Russians is part of an ever-expanding partnership with internationals. One of the things that President Obama challenged me to do when I first became the NASA administrator is to expand the number of nations with which we collaborated and try to find a way to bring on more and more of what we call non-traditional partners, countries, small countries generally, that did not have the financial wherewithal or maybe not even the scientific expertise to enter into the family of spacefaring nations on their own. So he tasked us to go out and try to find them, identify them, and then begin to work with them. And we have done that incredibly well. I will be on my way over to Ethiopia, for example, in November, where I'll have an opportunity to meet with representatives from a number of African nations who now have their own space agencies. The big ones are South Africa, Nigeria, Algiers, and that represents the incredible expansion on non-traditional partners that NASA has done in response to the president's desire to enhance our international collaboration. That's the international partner story in terms of expanding our partnerships to non-traditional partners. But with the International Space Station, Russia has become a very credible, reliable partner, and they've been a very important partner of ours over the last 15 plus years. We've been operating on the International Space Station without interruption for almost 14 years now, and the Russians have been a very reliable partner there. We ended up flying our crews to the International Space Station on Soyuz, not as a result of not having American-made vehicles, but as a result of the Columbia accident that left us unable to get our crews to space for a period of time. The Russians rose to the challenge and accepted the responsibility of transporting our crews to and from the International Space Station. We found that it worked well enough that we were going to continue to use Soyuz as the primary transport vehicle for our station crews. That would allow us to use the shuttle for transportation of the construction crews back and forth to space to finish construction of the International Space Station. So it was a partnership that enabled us to finish the International Space Station in a period of time that we said we were going to do that. We also have the Europeans, and the European Space Agency represents 22 or more European nations. About 16 of them are paying partners in the International Space Station. JAXA represents Japan. They're an integral part of the International Space Station team, and then the Canadian Space Agency. So the Russians are one of many international partners on whom we depend and with whom we are interdependent in operating on the International Space Station, as well as many of our scientific missions. We very seldom fly a robotic exploration mission today that doesn't involve the support and participation of one or more of our international partners.
We're speaking with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. So with the flights to the International Space Station from the United States in a couple of years, do you foresee Russian astronauts taking part in those?
I do. For the first time since we retired Shuttle here, hopefully in 2017, we will have three alternatives to get crews to the International Space Station. And my hope is that all of the partners will view the two NASA contracted vehicles as viable ways to get to and from the space station. So, I would expect that we would have Russian cosmonauts, Japanese astronauts, European astronaut, you know, any other astronauts with whom we're partnered, going either on a Dragon or on a CST-100 to the International Space Station.
And just because I've never done it, I have to ask, what's the best thing about going up in space?
It depends on the person, and I will try to be non-emotional about this. For me, the couple of best things about going up into space, let me start with the one that has nothing to do with going in space, but the most important thing for me was the incredible friendships, lifelong friendships that are made as a result of the training and preparation to fly. One of my best friends is Sergei Krikalev, who is a Russian cosmonaut. He was a crew member of mine. He and Vladimir Titov trained with my crew my very last space shuttle mission. We moved them and their families from Moscow to Houston, Texas, and they lived there for 2 years in the same neighborhoods that we did. We watched their kids grow up, watched them become Americanized, you know, before they went back home to Russia at the completion of our flight. But that has been one of the most memorable and invaluable parts of having an opportunity to go to space. If you look at it from the standpoint of, okay, what about being there? Just the opportunity to view Earth from the vantage point of Earth orbit is mind-boggling. It's mesmerizing. It's awesome. You see the planet as I wish everyone could see it, in all of its beauty and grandeur. It doesn't look like it's in as much trouble as it is. It also doesn't look like people are in as much peril as they are not being able to get along. It looks like one big happy planet, and it makes you wonder, you know, when you return or as you prepare to return, why we actually aren't that way. And then the other on-orbit thing that's fascinating is just the ability to float and be weightless and be unconstrained by gravity, to have your brain not function when it comes to knowing what's up and down because your inner ear, your vestibular system doesn't function without a gravity vector. So those are the two on-orbit things, but the before you go and after you come back thing is the incredible friendships that are formed as a result of preparation for flight and then the flight itself.